It is time for David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. You'll find David, of course, not only here live on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast David also during the week, during the noontime hour, and also on the weekends. But you can also find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good day, David.
Good day to you. Isn't it a great day to be in this country, the land of opportunity? It's a splendid land of opportunity, especially for us in the media. You know, if we were to just read the news at breakfast time, we could one day be the United States ambassador to the United Nations. Isn't that a splendid thought?
We have an ambassador that has just been named, and I think she has to be approved. A perfectly nice human being, probably. But the first thing that I remembered when I saw her name is that she actually thought that the United States and Germany were allies in World War II.
Yeah, I do recall that, too. You can't get everything right when you're a newsreader.
It came to my mind, and you know what came to my mind and made it even more silly? Is when you spend the past weekend, you watch, and I love the way this country celebrates its presidents. I really do, and honors them with a send-off. But whether you agreed with George Bush or not in his policies, just take a look at his resume before he was president. Take a look at a lot of people. There's amazing things that they do. And this latest appointee to the General Assembly as the United States representative at the UN has nothing but a broadcast background.
Mm-hmm. Well, less said the better, yeah. I fear. But it's worth commenting on in passing, at least. Now, Heather Nauert is her name, and I was a little unsure how to pronounce it. Nauert is apparently the correct pronunciation. I thought it was Nauert, as in nothing, a big fat zero. So let's move on, shall we?
What did you think? I mean, I was not. I did not vote for George Bush when he ran for president, but I did appreciate the accomplishments that happened during his 4 years, and like I said, there's just something great about the way America lays to rest its presidents.
Oh, sure. I'm impressed by the pageantry that is brought out for these occasions. I know America is not thought of as a great country for pageantry, and my old home country certainly is. So I've got a sort of baseline of comparison. But the presidential funeral is quite something to see. It is an extraordinary thing that America is, after all, one of its great slogans is E Pluribus Unum, coming out of many. It's one of those opportunities to demonstrate a form of national unity around that idea, just the showing of respect to a leader who's done valuable service. I'm not talking about this particular individual president in any totally admiring way. I think he was a man of mixed makeup, like all human beings. But sure, the demonstration of due deference and respect for someone who has done service, let's not miss the point that I think every speech made at that ceremony was making, that we live in very different times now from what they were when George H.W. Bush was president. That was the message that was rammed home, perhaps a little over emphatically at times. And of course, it was salutary, or at least it was cautionary, to be constantly aware in the cutaways to the front pew, the very front pew, which are all the living presidents sitting there, to see how little our current president seemed to be enjoying the occasion. I don't suppose funerals are meant to be enjoyed, but he seemed distinctly uncomfortable compared with everybody else.
Yeah, it was amazing. But you know, it's always amazing when you get to see all the living presidents together, and to see Barack Obama sitting next to the Clintons, and then sitting next to Jimmy Carter, who
looked terrific.
Who looks terrific for his age, and then to see Donald Trump
and recovering from cancer, of course.
And then you see Donald Trump, and it's just it's
recovering
something.
Recovering from who knows what?
Yeah, but it's
or
amazing.
Not recovering, perhaps. Yeah.
But a question, just back to pageantry for one moment, because of your old home country, which we will then switch to for a sec. Because do you think that there would be some benefit, given the money that's being made, keeping people divided and in their own boxes, some benefit in additional pageantry? Do you think? I mean, because that was one of the compelling things. Obviously, before the funeral, there was some talk, lots of talk. So the president won't go, blah, 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 blah. And my view, which turned out to be borne out, was, hey, this is protocol. This is, you know, this is different. And sure enough, a lot of people resonated, irrespective of their feelings. And that's the whole thing about, if you will, sounds almost fatuous, but that's the whole thing about showing respect. You know, you don't have to like so ranging from anything to most of to some of. That's not what it's about. When you are honoring someone or you are showing respect, it's for it's for something bigger than like whether you like the way the guy brushed his teeth.
Yes, so in large part it was about the individual, but then it was also not about the individual. It was about the occupant of a high office. Yeah, and that is the notion which is behind a lot of our concern about the occupant of the man or the person who sits behind the resolution desk in the Oval Office of the White House, the People's House. It is the notion, it's the presidency that's being in some ways not regarded in the same way that it used to be, because the occupant of the office is not regarding it in the same way that previous occupants regarded it too. I mean, the respect is not just a one-way street, and if even the occupant of the office treats it with disrespect, uses it for self-centered aims, then of course it's bound to go into disrepute, and that's a dangerous state for a stable democracy, and it's, you know, it's in danger of becoming destabilized because of that.
And this again brings me slightly to my other question, because you have people who very much feel that way, and then you have people who don't feel that way. And that is such a communication problem, I wouldn't even know where to begin. So,
Would you try to begin? I mean,
would I? Sure. Yeah, but we know that I love fool's errands, and I just can't stand, I am such a middleist, you know, that I cannot bear, I become unhinged when I talk to someone who's like, there's nobody at the border, and someone who's, they're throwing rocks at the border. You know, I can't fathom the efficiency on any level of having that much of a disparity in reality.
Well, extremities and the forcefulness of extremities and the primacy almost of extremities are one of the biggest dangers to any democracy. The country or the part of a country that I perhaps reported on more than any other single governmental entity is Northern Ireland in the British Isles. And there is a case where everyone kept saying, well, if only the middleists like you, Jill, if only the middleists could get a grip on the communication of centrist positions in this country, this province of Northern Ireland, then all will be well. Well, what was happening is that the big mass of people who are Middleists or centrists are there in the middle, but there are the extreme Republicans at one end and there are extreme Unionists on the other. Loyalists are so-called because they're loyal to Britain, and the Republicans want to join the Republic of Ireland. Now, in the end, increasingly over time, and partly as a result of violence, it has to be admitted, the violence did happen as a result of this layout of political opinion. Many people killed over two or three decades. But in the end, what happened was that the extremes got the power, both extremes, and they ended up sharing power in a quite uncanny kind of way. But that was an extraordinary demonstration of the power of extremities. And you know, I always worry when I look at countries where that kind, you know, that kind of extremism is setting in, because it can spell the end of a stable democracy, if that's what you have in the first place. And it certainly doesn't help in the creation of one. Northern Ireland is a remarkable place because, in a sense, it's an exception to the rule, because they ended up, because of the two extremes getting together, having peace for 20 years now, a peace which, ironically or perhaps inevitably logically, is now coming under huge strain because of a different kind of extremity, coming from extreme politics anyway, coming from the mainland of Britain. Northern Ireland didn't vote to say yes to Brexit, but England did, and now that's proving to be a problem for Northern Ireland more than any other part of the United Kingdom.
And now you've made my life so easy with that segue, because part of what I am trying to find out, just as a thinking person. And I just also have to add that being a Middleist is not quite the same as being a centrist.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, but admittedly, we could probably come up with a better name for it.
Neither one is a particularly attractive label, I have to say.
And there get implications at all events. Excuse this question. I am desperate for actual information, because the way that the press seems to operate, essentially, so that they can keep making money and sending their kids to school and all of that good stuff, is disaster, 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 disaster. Oh, it's okay. Disaster, disaster. Oh, that's done. So what I'm really trying to find out is is the possibility of this particular agreement surviving the vote next, allegedly, but next Tuesday? And will there be a vote, I guess?
Well, the agreement that Prime Minister Theresa May has negotiated, or her officers of state have negotiated with the European Union, is essentially, if I can oversimplify vastly, is that Britain will leave Europe, and the deadline for that, of course, is March of next year. But they, well, leaving the Union itself, they will remain in a kind of economic linkage with them, to the extent that customs and trade between, border customs and import duties and all that kind of thing that accompany the import and export of goods and services between different parts of the world. It's as if they would be out of the European Union overall, but would remain within its remit in terms of trade. And not completely, but it's not as if they're going to be treated in the same terms as if they were still in. That's not the case. They will have to pay customs duties and all the rest of it, but there will be a relationship that continues, apparently open-ended, and indeed under the terms of this agreement, the length of the of this relationship will be determined by the European Union, and Britain itself can't pull out of it single-handed. So it's a very peculiar halfway house. And of course, it's extremely disappointing. It's infuriating, in fact, for those people who led the push to get Brexit accomplished in the first place, the Brexiteers. And the Brexiteers are making it very difficult for Prime Minister May to get this agreement that she's made with Europe through the House of Parliament. So, yes, there's a severe risk that she's not going to get that passage, and she'll be in severe danger of losing control of her own party, her own hold on office herself too. Now, how likely is it that it's going to pass through? How reasonable are these fears? I'd say the likelihood of it not getting through is very high, and the fears are very justified. No reason for, you know, wild panic in the streets, I don't think. It's not that kind of issue. Except, of course, that the media will be, as you say, many in the media will be trying to flam it up and present it as a potential constitutional disaster. It's not that, but it's certainly an effort which is... I'm sure it's an effort that has required a huge amount of dedication and many long hours of burning candles at both ends. But it's not going to work for the very people that the whole exercise is meant to satisfy, people who want Britain fully out of the European Union.
What's interesting to watch is, and I want to bring this up, what's happening in France at this same time. With a gas tax. It started out as a gas tax revolt, and it's grown into something quite different than that. The energy that's gone into that. I look at Brexit and what might happen with Brexit, and it's not going to come that way, but whoever thought that in France the installation of a gas tax became so politicized that now it's bigger than that.
Well, except that the gas tax was just... There are those sides, and that's interesting in its own right. So let me get back to Brexit. That's interesting in its own right, simply because the people that the gas tax affected, literally, it was not sustainable, and this was sort of a spring up. It's just this doesn't work.
But it's gone beyond gas tax now. There's other violent people that have gotten involved for other reasons.
Yeah, which is another wonder of...
which is what I'm wondering, will that happen at Brexit?
I doubt... Well, this is... Okay, that's a good question.
David, what do you think? Could it expand on other matters than Brexit?
They're
or
British.
Will it just stay Brexit?
There is something of a tradition in France of... popular uprising, of course. I mean, we still venerate the French Revolution right across the world in many cases. And people in the streets making their point is a very, you know, favored form of
expression.
Political expression in France. Yeah, not so much in Britain, except that, you know, it has to be said that some of the biggest rallies ever in British political history were about whether or not we should go into, well, they were about a desire not to go into the Iraq war. And Britain has, of course, its own popular uprising tradition too. We the French weren't the only ones, for instance, to execute their king. We did that too a good few centuries ago.
And a couple of times, but that's right.
But it has to be said that the Brexit issue doesn't look to me like the sort of issue that will bring out hundreds of thousands of people into the streets.
With yellow vests on.
On the other hand, Marshall has a point. Latching other issues onto popular discontent is a feature of politics worldwide, and it may well go that way. There is a particular sharp focus about this whole issue of Brexit, though, that and it is one that divides people right across traditional political boundaries. It's there are pro-Europe and anti-Europe people in both the governing Conservative Party and the opposition Labour Party. So it has value itself as an issue. The case in France is that yes, it's a gas tax, but it's also about it's about gearing up as a country would want to do, a sensibly governed country would want to do, for climate change. This is all about a shift away from fossil fuels, which in some ways there's a lot of support for in France, a lot. But at the same time, you've got, I think here, a demonstration of another phenomenon which the French really don't take kindly to, which is elitism in government.
Right.
And the sense that President Macron is out of touch with the people in general has been growing over the last 12 months or more of his rule as president. And this is a case in point. If your device to usher in a move away from fossil fuels to sustainable forms of energy is, as you said before, Marshall, the crude imposition of a gas tax, then you're going to be in trouble, because of course it's the less well off who are going to suffer most. And that, of course, is guaranteed to bring French people out into the streets. So I think because they're different kinds of issues, I don't think you'll have it developing in the same political way. But I could be wrong, of course. I mean, the British have been somewhat unpredictable in the last 2 years, as indeed our own electorate has over here. I wouldn't want to be held to the stake about this, but I don't think we're going to see uprisings in the street in Britain.
Because you're right, when you take a look at the United States, anything that becomes politicized all of a sudden because of, and I'm going to say this and certain people are going to get upset, idiots that know how to use social media to anger people, really change the topic of conversation. And people get mad about something that's not even related to the initial topic, all through social media. It's absolutely amazing the way they're manipulated.
And then because the wonder that social media now runs regular news, that becomes the news, and the next thing you know, you've got, you know, something that started as a bin fire that's just raging out of control. So let me just go back to Brexit for 1 second. I thought, David, that you handled that beautifully diplomatically. I personally think that you should be the UN ambassador, but
I've worked with
he you, doesn't watch
I'm, sure. I'm not sure that I'm a good fit.
He doesn't watch Fox News enough.
No, I work for the UN, and I stress that it's a past tense.
I understand. Yes,
I did leave.
You did, and lived to tell. But before we run out of time, what I do want to ask is, bottom line, as a middleist, it sounds like a crap. Excuse me, am I allowed to say that?
Which middleist is a worse term.
All right. It sounds like a crap deal. Is that true?
There are degrees of bad language.
All right. So as a middleist, okay, just someone who's
saying that word.
Is it a crap deal or not?
The deal that Prime Minister May has negotiated.
Well, that everybody's worked very hard on. I totally understand. It just seems like, yeah, you know, it seems like wet bread, which anyone who knows just knows that there's nothing that repulses me more.
I haven't heard it described that way until you uttered that great phrase.
Yeah.
But I think it's very apt. Yeah, it's not a great deal. If the purpose is to ensure tidy and trouble-free, well, not trouble-free, because nothing will be trouble-free entirely, but a reasonably smooth exit without businesses crashing all over the place because of the rapid change in their economic circumstances in and out of the European Union, then it's probably a good deal. But if the purpose is to get Britain fully out of Europe, then that's not what this is.
I was going to say, they can call it non-Brexit because it's not Brexit.
Well, sure, exactly. It's not Brexit. I mean, I state my own position since I'm not reporting on Britain anymore. But I don't live there, of course. But if I did live there, I would not have been voting for Brexit. I think it's an insane idea. But you can see why people who did want to get out of Brexit will be so furious with this deal, because it is not what the majority of British people voted for.
But here's the whole thing. I compare it to this. President Trump is very happy that we got out of NAFTA. No, we didn't. It's just to minimize NAFTA. It's still NAFTA. And now you look at Brexit and you're going to vote on this. It's not Brexit. It's not. Countries all over the world are doing this. Political leaders are doing this all over the world. They're putting something forward that's not what they're putting forward.
And the thing to watch now is whether or not the British system will take the idea, which is gaining more and more traction. Although, you know, I was one to dismiss it earlier on, but that there could be a very forceful push, which could succeed, in calling a second referendum
and give the
British people the chance to express some second thoughts. Because many people have, of course, had second thoughts now that we've gotten down to the nitty-gritty of negotiations.
And in the miserable 1 minute that we have left, just apropos, that has been under that pot has been stirred, you know, gradually over the past couple of years. And, you know, if it happens, then it will be because of a lot of just spade work behind the scenes to get that going.
All right.
Behind the scenes and upfront, raising it again and again and again. Yep. Yes, absolutely.
And I hate to have to say this, but thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.